I just find that so amazing. I have noticed in my life that if I don't listen to the kind, smiling, whispering Jesus, he will amp up the volume a little bit, just like my dad did. I have noticed that if my behavior is especially destructive to me and to others, he knows exactly the right way to pull my plug. But that's not because he doesn't love me. It's exactly the opposite reason. It's because he does love me, and that's the only thing that'll work. God would rather not judge. He'd rather be merciful. It's his first choice. But he will judge if the mercy doesn't work. So why not just, like Jesus said a couple of weeks ago, just fall on the rock, be humbled, be broken. You can be healed, but don't let the rock fall on you. The rock falls on you, you're powder, you're toast, you're dead. So just fall on the rock. Verse 36, I tell you the truth, all of this, and then all of the devastation that he prophesied, it will come upon this generation. I had you underline that word. It's the Greek word is the word genea, which is spelled Genea. It means either generation in the sense that we mean it, a family of people, but it can also mean a group of like-minded people. Technically, a lynch mob could be used with this, could be described with the same Greek word, genea. Why would he say that to this one group of guys? He's saying, look, every bit of righteous blood that's ever been shed by you and your ilk is going to come down on your heads. You guys, these guys right here, hearing my words. Why? Well, because the most righteous blood ever to course through human veins was about to be spilled by these guys. You know what I find really ironic? If you flip over to verse 27, excuse me, chapter 27, verse 25, the bloodthirsty crowd is crying for Pilate to kill Jesus. And Pilate doesn't want to. Read those, they are chilling words. They said, let his blood be on us. So, what Jesus says as a warning for them to change, to sober them up, they wound up asking for what became their own condemnation. Isn't that just what irony? C.S. Lewis said that in the final analysis, when all humans face God, all human beings are going to be broken into two groups. There's one group that said, God, your will be done. And the other group is the group that God looks at them and says, human, your will be done. You didn't want me in your life? Okay, forever, you can have me not in your life. You are not going to like it. It's going to be worse than anything you can imagine. But you don't want me? Okay. I will not force myself on you. I do find it so remarkable. If you take all of that in line with verse 37, oh, Jerusalem, Jerusalem. Remember, these guys were Mr. Jerusalem. These were the poster children for all of the brightest and best of Jerusalem. Looking at the religious leaders on down, Jesus just, oh, Jerusalem, Jerusalem, you kill the prophets, stone everybody sent to you. How often I have longed to gather you together under my wings. Ever seen a chicken do that? It's a pretty cool thing. I live right on a lake, and I have a whole bunch of last year I had 66 Canada geese in my backyard. I don't know, word must have got around because the year before there was only about 30 of them. They must be having babies or something. But it was interesting once that I saw a, I don't know if it was an osprey, some kind of a large hawk sitting in a tree where they could all see him last year when they had about 12 little duckies, babies, fuzzy little yellow ducklings. And the mom spotted the hawk and did this obnoxious, you know, honking thing that geese do. And all of the little babies just came. And she fluffed herself out and spread her wings out, and they all got under there. And I thought, well, that's a pretty cool thing. And I suddenly realized that she was making herself the target. You want to kill my babies? You go through me first. All of you mothers will understand that instinct. Have you thought where that heart comes from? Who invented that, so to speak? That's the heart that Jesus has. That's what he's saying here in verse 37. John Corson pointed out something, as he often does, that I never thought of before when I was reading what he said about this, that every place in the Gospels where Jesus repeated somebody's name twice, he always did it because his heart was breaking. Simon, Simon, you think you're okay. You're the one that's going to fail. But I'm praying for you. Martha, Martha, talk about majoring in minor things. Martha, Martha, get off Mary's case. She's picked the best thing to do. The bagels will be okay if they're not perfectly toasted. I'm willing to, you know, sleep on dirty sheets, but Mary's discovered the most important thing. Martha, Martha, this is the important thing. And later, on the road to Damascus, Saul, Saul, buddy, you're killing me. You're killing people I love. And the more you're convicted, the harder you kick against the goads. Who's the one that's getting worse pain? And here he says, Jerusalem, Jerusalem, how often I've longed. I had you underline the word longed, if you've got an NIV as I do. And down at the end of the verse, the word willing. It's a great word. In fact, I like the word so much that I looked up every place that I could find that it uses as. And then, because I'm just starting to learn Hebrew, I found the equivalent word in my Hebrew dictionary, and I started looking up all the scriptures where that was, and I found some fabulous, fabulous scriptures. This word means a desire which springs from strong emotion. I think I wrote down, yes, a desire springing from deep emotion and will. It's not just a feeling. One Greek commentary said, it's a strong desire springing from an emotion that will not let me stop until I do something about it. I love that. Often, how often, that's an exclamation. How often, from my heart, I've wanted to gather you together. Why didn't that happen? Because from your heart, you didn't want it. Could I tell you that that's still true? Back in the Jesus movement days when everybody had obnoxious and semi-obnoxious bumper stickers about Jesus, there was one that said, if you feel far away from God, guess who moved? Meaning God hasn't gone anywhere. His heart hasn't changed. If I'm far from God, it's not because he's walking away, it's because I'm walking away. That's what Jesus is saying. Can I tell you a couple of places where this word appears, or at least one very similar to it? If you're looking at the difference between Hebrew and Greek. where it says God is not willing from his heart that one of these little ones would perish, Matthew 18. Peter says in one of his epistles, God is not willing from his heart that any would perish, but that everybody would turn around, come to repentance. I just found one yesterday, Lamentations 3:33, which is really cool because I'm teaching Job on Wednesday nights. The story of Job troubles a lot of people. It makes a lot of people angry, and actually until you study it. And when you study it, you realize that your initial impression is very different than what actually went down. But Lamentations, which is a dirge that Jeremiah wrote over the utter devastation of Israel because they just continued in the rebellion and God allowed their place to be destroyed and allowed them to be taken into captivity. But Jeremiah talks about God's kindness being what leads us to repentance, not his threats. And then Lamentations 3:33 says, for God is not willing from his heart to afflict anyone or send grief to anyone. Is that the God that you know? It's sure not the God I was raised with. The God that I was raised with might have had a restraining hand, but if you let go of that restraining hand, he'd smoke you, baby. I mean, he had a fistful of lightning bolts and he was just ready to fling them. The Bible paints such an opposite picture of that. Yeah, God did judge people. But if you read all those Old Testament judgments, you realize that he had warned them sometimes for decades. He had put up with them. And finally, when he did something, he even then held back. Even when he caused them to be taken into Babylon captives, it was for 70 years. And when they got depressed during that 70 years, he says, oh, I'm going to bring you back to your own land. When I printed out that page full of promises for Wednesday night, by the way, if you weren't here, there's some sitting out on the counter out there. That wonderful promise that almost every Christian knows. Jeremiah 29:11, where God says, I know the plans that I have for you. And they're plans for good and not for evil. Plans to give you a future and hope. Do you know that was spoken to people who were in the process of suffering God's judgment because of their rebellion? The only reason they lost their city, the only reason they were even in Babylon was because God says, that's it. I warned you, I warned you, I warned you. And so they're captives in Babylon, and God says, hey, that's not the end of my plan. I have a future for you. I have a hope for you. See why Easter changes everything? If you ever doubt the lengths that God is willing to go to take care of the sin issue and bring us close to him, all you have to do is look at the Easter story. So, from my heart, he's saying, I love you. The only reason that we're not together is simply because you didn't want it from your heart, and I did. Which, that tells me something else. That tells me that God isn't going to force himself on you. You don't want him to be part of your life, he won't be. But he isn't going to force himself. Don't everybody leave, okay? We've still got about 6 or 7 minutes. We pointed out last week that when he said, your house is left to you desolate, that was literally going to be true. But do you remember when Jesus came in and kicked all the cheats out of the temple? He said, this is supposed to be my Father's house. It's supposed to be a place where people make contact with God. You guys are ripoff artists right in the place that's supposed to be my Father's house. Notice now in the prophecy, he's not calling it his Father's house anymore. Now he's saying it's your house. I'm out of here. And it's going to be left desolate. I looked up that word desolate, and it was sobering. It means abandoned of God's presence and help. Why was Jesus saying all this in such harsh terms? Well, because he knew his time was short. He knew their time was short. I do find it so remarkable that he was going to spend 37 more years before Titus and the Romans came in and just leveled the place. One historian says that the number of people that were slaughtered in Jerusalem was hundreds of thousands. And they found the second largest Jewish community in the area, which was Damascus, and slit the throats of 10,000 Jews. That's how brutal the Romans were. Did God do that? No, he didn't. Jesus is warning them that that's what's ahead. Could it have been forestalled? Well, we don't really get to know that, do we? But he warned them. And he warned them to turn their hearts to him. This whole passage has got a different flavor to it than it used to me. He said, you know what? There's a time coming where that messianic song that you sang, the blessed is he that comes in the name of the Lord, you know, hoop-de-doo, that whole thing that you do, that's going to be real. I'm going to march. Me, the guy in a couple of days you're going to kill, and then you're not going to see him again for a while. I am coming back. I love that thing that Jimmy read. Yeah, they did kill him, but he came back. Yeah, the world pretty much is ignoring him and has been for a long time, but he is coming back. So, next time that we look at chapter 24, we'll begin looking at what Jesus said about those end times. And I can't wait, because it's remarkable to me how dense and unaware many religious people are to how Bible prophecy about the end times is being fulfilled every single day in front of our eyeballs. And there are still people out playing the game of, well, we're going to take over politically and we'll make everybody be good. And they're just not getting it. They're not seeing, no, Jesus said, this is the way it's going to go down. And you see everything in place. He said, lift up your eyes, because your rescue is very, very close. So how's God feel about you? Well, look how he felt about his extreme enemies. Have you ever felt that tug in your heart where Jesus said the same words to you that he said in verse 37? Often, often, many, many times. I just wanted to put my arms around you. But you just really didn't give a rip. I wanted to, but I couldn't, because you didn't want to. And that's a very sobering, melting thing, because that's happened to me. Finally, when I got around to talking with him, there was a point in my life when I realized he'd been following me around all day long. Just wanting a little FaceTime. Wanting to comfort me. And it was not because he didn't want it, it's because I didn't want it. I was too busy. I had lots of other stuff to do. Isn't it ironic that he said these words to religious people? Why even be a religious person if you don't love Jesus? That's my question. If Jesus was not real, if he didn't have this kind of heart, I would not be in church. I can tell you that. I can tell you a lot of other places I would be, but this is not one of them. So I don't get it. I don't understand why people play those kind of games unless they think that's all that there is. But when you see this heart, and you see this heart that was going to put his money where his mouth is, he was going to lay his life down, there ought to be no question how God feels about us, should there? This is a great Easter message. And you know what's really interesting? we're still a couple of months away from being able to actually get to the crucifixion and the resurrection, as it'll take, it's going to take. It'll be summertime before. And of all the chapters, to have the wonderful message of God's love, the one that I used to dread, the woe chapter. But see, there was just so much stuff I didn't see right there. So let that be the message you carry with you. If everything else, and yeah, maybe you're not a rat like these guys were, but you just see God's heart towards the rats. How does he feel about the ones that are trying to please him? Just keep that in your mind. How often I've longed to put my arms around you. And if it happened, it happened because you were willing. And if it didn't happen, it's because you weren't willing. But it was never, he's saying, because I wasn't willing. Because I'm always willing. Remember the hypocrisy versus the struggling with sin thing. That's an important one. I promise you it is going to take time for all of your habits to change. You're a new creation. In the truest spiritual sense of that is you have a new life in you that didn't exist before you gave yourself to Jesus. But you still live in that stinky body. If you were a bad cook when you gave your life to Jesus, you're going to be a bad cook. But you may be in the frame of mind where somebody could teach you to be a good cook in a better way than you were before. But he's committed. He's committed from the inside out to making us whole and complete. And that's good news. And he proved it. So, you can still go to hell if you want to. But it'll be over his dead body. Let's pray. How good this news is to me, Lord. I'm so embarrassed that I saw a scowl on your face for so much of my life when it wasn't you at all. I'm even more embarrassed that when I know how much you want to be with me and how much you love me, that I have just blown you off and pushed you away and ignored you. Yet still your heart longs for closeness with us, and I love that about you. Lord, I pray that our hearts would be open to you today. Nothing could distance us from you when all that needed to be done to make you accessible was done at the cross. May we welcome you, Lord, eagerly. I want to be like my sister Monica, and if I know you're in the next room, I'll shove everybody out of the way and bust the door down because I want to be with you. Lord, when we stink, you are the safest place for us to run, because you won't leave us that way. Lord, I pray that